Ohea o ko ka aha. Ina he kuleana I mua ohea aha ho kolo kolo kie kie hana hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nā I mai, e malio mai, I lohe ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo. Please be seated.
Case number SCWC-17-427, State v. Thompson. Argument on the merits.
Counsel, please note your appearance on the record.
Johnny Tanaka, Deputy Public Defender, on behalf of Petitioner Defendant Appellant James Thompson.
Good morning, Deputy Prosecutor
Attorney Thompson. Mr. Kinaga.
Your Honor, just to clarify, I did reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you. In our application for certiorari, we raised three issues. And with the court's permission, I'd like to begin with the issue on whether the court erred in imposing a more severe sentence on Mr. Thompson's after his collateral attack on his original sentence. Under HRS 706-609, the court is prohibited from imposing a more severe sentence after the defendant's original sentence is vacated after collateral attack. And the term more severe is not specifically defined by the statute. We are arguing that there are two aspects of why this sentence was more severe. First, as a general proposition, a consecutive sentence is always more severe than a concurrent sentence.
Is that what our law says?
Yes, I believe in Kahapea, the court recognized that a consecutive sentence is more severe than a concurrent sentence. In addition, under 706-668.5, concurrent sentencing is the default for sentencing.
Mr. Thompson received an enhanced sentence, though, the first time around.
Correct.
So it's not comparing a regular concurrent sentence with a consecutive. Isn't it comparing the consecutive with the previous enhanced sentence?
Correct. The second basis, however, for why we believe it's a more severe sentence is that Mr. Thompson's sentence resulted in a significant loss of credit on a number of counts. So under the 2017 judgment, under reconfiguration, he lost all of the credit for time served that he had previously gained on 9 counts.
You know, counsel, I just don't follow that argument. Subsection 2, 706-671, subsection 2 says, when a judgment of a conviction or a sentence is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime, the period of detention and imprisonment theretofore served shall be deducted from the minimum and maximum terms of the new sentence. Why doesn't that apply?
Correct. And when the sentences were running concurrently, he was gaining credit on all counts. So by 2017, he had approximately 17 years of credit on each of the counts. Then with the reconfiguration of the sentences, the credit was basically taken away from the sentences, the later sentences that ran consecutively.
I think, well, first of all, is there anything in the record showing that the paroling authority didn't give him credit for those 17 years? And secondly, is the state even contesting it? The way I read their briefs and their statement at the sentencing proceeding, they're not contesting that he gets 17 years of credit for all the time that he previously served.
When the Hawaii Paroling Authority calculates credit for time served on sentences, I believe it's semi-pursuant to Tau Ili Ili, they run the sentences, the minimum sentences, consecutively. So he would not have credit on the counts that he previously had credit for under the concurrent sentencing.
Okay,
however, he does get the 17 years credit toward his aggregate sentence.
Assuming what you're saying is true, it's not before us, number one. And number two, Ta'ili interpreted subsection 1, not subsection 2.
Correct. However, in terms of whether this sentence is more severe, what we're trying to point out to the court is that previous cases have focused strictly on comparing the number of years of the sentence. So comparing two five-year consecutive terms of, for instance, two concurrent extended 10-year terms, saying that was equivalent. In this case, however, we're asking the court to look at more than just the number of years in the sentence. And that's consistent with the fact that 706-609 does not define more severe and does not specifically limit it to the number of years served in the sentence.
But in order to do that, let's assume I agree with you that more severe is defined by what actually happens. I don't see what the minimum term. You're asking us to assume something that's not in the record. You're pointing to a practice, and I'm looking at a statute, a subsection, and I'm also looking at the government, and I'll ask them about it, but their statement in their brief said, look, we're not contesting he gets credit for that. Isn't that what their response was to you?
Correct. Well, the minimum term was actually set several months after the sentence date, so after the case had already been, we had appealed the sentence. So
I understand that. I'm not saying that, but maybe what your remedy, your correct remedy, if in fact what you say is true, it's a Rule 40 from the setting of the minimum term, but right now you're asking us to, there's two things you're asking us, at least. You're saying, look, when you're defining more severe, we want you to go beyond the sentence. We want you to look at what actually happened. And I'm saying to you, that may be a good premise. But then you're saying you can't give us the record for it to establish it because it happened afterwards.
We're actually not pointing so much at the parole record because under Chiodi, I believe the court stated that parole considerations are separate from sentencing considerations. So in terms of why this is more severe, it's just a simple credit for time served on, in terms of the way the sentences were configured. Now, that is given regardless of what the paroling authority does. He's entitled to credit for time served under Tau'ili'ili in a certain method, in this case, the consecutive
but
term.
Tau'ili'ili talked about pretrial detention, and there was a reasoning that they gave in Tau'ili'ili was because if they gave credit for the consecutive sentences, a person who was not in custody would be disadvantaged as compared to someone who was in custody. That analysis doesn't apply to your situation because subsection 2 is applicable, and subsection 2 gives every single person who's incarcerated credit for time that they've served on that sentence if that sentence eventually gets vacated.
Correct.
That's what the subsection says.
Correct. We're looking at that. If you're looking at the aggregate sentence, I do agree with you. He did get 17 years of credit on his aggregate sentence. However, he did not, as he previously had individual sentence, get credit for time served under each count of that sentence.
Could I ask you about that, Mr. Ikenaga? Just to get to the specifics of the numbers, even if we're talking about Section 2 and granted that there's credit for 17 years, let's assume that life with parole is the sentence. Credit for 17 years would be calculated how with respect to life with parole? Well, there would be a minimum set, correct?
Correct.
By the paroling authority.
Correct.
And then the 17 years would be applied to that.
To his, toward his life sentence, he would have 17 years. And then
right, and towards the minimum, whatever the minimum is set, right? So with life, the minimum could be what? Could it be more than 20 years?
Yes.
Yes. So then you theoretically get credit for 17 years of what would be even more than 20 years. On the other hand, if it's a maximum sentence of 20 years, and assuming that Apprendi applies and the sentence can't be more than 20 years without a factual determination by the jury, then if credit was given for the 17 years, what would be the remaining amount on the sentence?
He would have, if all the sentences ran concurrently, he would have 3 years left if it was a 20-year sentence.
And is this your point?
Correct.
Can I ask you about, let's count 13, 1 year sentence. The defendant has entirely served that sentence under the prior judgment. So are you saying now that the government is arguing or the HPA or whoever it is are going to say, despite the fact that he served the entirety of his 1 year sentence, we're going to take that away and we're going to say he has to re-serve that sentence?
Yes. And in fact,
but I understand that's the argument, but that's not what the judgment says. It says the defendant shall have credit for time already served. That's what it says. And our statute doesn't say what you're saying is going to be the result.
I think that would be, if that is the case, then that is the court's interpretation, we could actually bring that up on a Rule 40, because under the current configuration, the way that HPA does the minimum terms is he would only get credit, he wouldn't get credit against the aggregate of all the sentences or the consecutive sentences. He would only get it on the first count, then it would consecutively apply to the next counts as it, those counts expired, the minimum terms on those counts.
There would be something fundamentally a due process violation to eliminate a sentence that someone had already served.
Correct.
Would you not agree?
Yes, and that happened for a number of counts, not just for the jail count.
I understand. Completed all the 10-year. Yes.
What remedy are you asking for, Mr. Ikenaga?
In terms of the 706-609 violation, we're arguing that we're asking the court to vacate the judgment and sentence, the 2017 judgment and sentence, and remand for resentencing.
How is that sentence more severe?
The two aspects we feel make it more severe are, one, just the general proposition that consecutive sentencing is more severe than concurrent sentencing. And I believe the court also said that as well in Apprendi as well, the U.S. Supreme Court. And this court talked about it in Kahapea as well. So that's one aspect. The second aspect is, I think what I've been going over with Justice Pollack and Justice Wilson at this point, is that he had credit for time served. In fact, had completed credit. He had completed his sentence on numerous counts. Under the reconfiguration, the way that the credit is given to him, he does not have credit.
Okay, so that's a separate issue that's really not here, because we're talking about parole, right? And credit for time served and possibility of parole based on credit for time served?
To some degree, but however, if we look at it that way, he had completed, even leaving parole aside, he had completed his sentence on the number of counts by 2017. By now, he would have completed his sentence on additional counts, including some of the sex one counts. That credit was, and so those sentences he's now serving time on.
I thought he's,
I'm sorry?
I thought he had been incarcerated for 17 years.
In 2017, he was incarcerated for about 17 years.
Okay.
So,
and
he had, a little over, so he's pretty close to his 20 years.
Yeah, you just said he completed his terms.
On the sex assault threes, and he would be
on the, you said on sex assault ones.
Yes, okay.
But he has not, right?
No, not yet.
All right.
Yes.
So the resentencing that you're anticipating when you said remand for resentencing, what does that look like to you? Is there going to be, in your view, an Apprendi type of determination made by a jury?
Well, that would go to our second issue, that we believe that Apprendi applies.
Okay, let's assume it applies. Then what does that mean on remand to you?
Well, if the state were to seek consecutive term sentencing again, we would argue that the normal protections accorded by Apprendi and the court, this court established in Malgautea and Jess apply, so that a jury would have to be convened in order to make the determination as to whether the factors supporting consecutive term sentencing.
And what is that? Then what, I mean, we are talking about here consecutive sentencing,
yes,
right? As opposed to sentencing that would be, for example, repeat offender. Repeat offender requires a determination of danger to the public. Consecutive sentencing doesn't appear to require that, right? For consecutive sentencing, you just refer back to the normal sentencing factors in 706-600, right?
Yes, 706-606 factors. Well, the court is mandated to apply this, to consider the 706-606 factors in determining whether to run the sentence consecutively.
Right.
Additionally, under Hussein, the court is required to make specific findings supporting its decision.
What I was interested in getting your help on, Mr. Ikenaga, is what would that factual determination be? Is it danger to the public? Because that doesn't seem to be specifically required for consecutive sentencing. What is the factual determination the court would have to make, I mean the jury would have to make, in order to have consecutive sentencing?
Well, I believe it would be any of whichever the state chose to rely upon.
So 706-606 factors.
Correct.
Aren't those the same factors that a court has to address in ruling whether or not to sentence a defendant to imprisonment or probation?
Correct.
So are you saying then a jury trial is required for every sentencing determination now?
No. The reason that we're saying that the 706-606 factors take a different character when it applies to consecutive sentencing is, one, because the court is obviously, the court is always mandated in a regular sentencing and consecutive term sentencing to consider those factors. However, under Hussein, this court stated that the court must make specific findings as to which factors it relied upon.
What was the reason for that?
It was to, I believe one of the reasons was to facilitate appellate review, to make sure that the judge was not abusing his discretion, to give the defendant notice of why he was being sentenced to what amounts to a greater sentence than the statute.
So the reason is to facilitate review versus extended, which are absolutely required by the legislature, and specifically point to finding specific facts that an extended term is necessary for the protection of the public.
Correct.
It's quite different.
Again, one point to Hussein, which requires the court to now make specific findings in support of its consecutive term sentencing. In addition, initially when Apprendi came out and the court was faced with Malgaltea 1 and Malgaltea 2, there was no process by which the lower courts were to determine the sentencing procedures. So at this point, yes, it's not in the statute. There's no statutory specific statute.
The statute has always had extended term necessary for the protection of the public. That existed, and that, in fact, is the basis for those decisions. That isn't new.
Correct. But Apprendi required that decision, the factual basis for those decisions, to be made by a jury. And that's what we're asking in this case. We're not saying that the court may not inherently make a factual determination on the record, but we're saying that Apprendi says that the court shouldn't be doing that because a consecutive term sentence extends the maximum sentence that the defendant serves.
Okay, but in one situation, you're requiring a factual determination because the legislature has required it. In this situation, what our law says is you should consider the factors and state on the record. So what would prohibit a court from saying in this specific case, look, there were multiple victims in this case, and based upon their age, and these are all things that were found by the jury, that would be sufficient. So there'd be no need for all those findings have already been found by the jury in returning verdicts of guilt on the four charges.
There could be an overlap of factual proof in terms of the factors. So for instance, a factor could be supported by the jury's verdict. However, it could also go beyond that. And at the point where the state is alleging that consecutive term sentencing is necessary, it sets forth the bases for that.
I'm interested in what you're referring to when you say there could be an overlap, because the question that Justice Pollack asked about whether you would require for findings of fact that would support consecutive sentencing, whether you would require a factual determination other than what the jury found, seems to be what's being discussed here. And you're saying there could be certain circumstances where the findings of fact would, I guess, go beyond what the jury decided. But help me with that. Like, for example, what would be, especially if the court only has to look at 706-606, right, which is, Justice McKenna says, is the normal sentencing factors for any sentence, how do you argue that there are going to be facts that apply to the sentencing that weren't already found by the jury for consecutive sentencing?
Well, for example, in 706, 661, and 662, the extended term sentencing, the preliminary inquiry is whether it's necessary for the protection of the public.
I'm sorry, but you sort of lost me there. Now you're going over to 706-661, but that's for extended terms.
Okay.
Is your position that that applies to consecutive too?
No.
Okay.
That factor is mirrored in 706-606, so protection of the public. So there are factors which I would say are set forth in the normal sentencing factors, which in a normal sentencing are at the discretion of the court, which are also factors which, under current case law and the statutory, provisions are required to be made by a jury pursuant to Apprendi. So when, in answer to Justice Pollack's question, I was trying to point out that there could be some instances where the facts supported at trial could support one or partial of the part of the factors which are normally set forth. However, despite that, I think Apprendi would still require that if you're going to rely on specific facts in order to increase the sentence, which we argue consecutive sentencing is, then you have to have those found by a jury.
So even if the jury's already found the facts, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Even if the jury's already found those facts, you lost me there.
Well, for instance, it's the interpretation of those facts that may. So, for instance, if I may go back to that protection of the public factor, the court could say, well, the jury in finding that this guy was a multiple offender, the jury found that's necessary for protection of the public because he had to put him away. However, when that factor becomes a basis for extending the defendant's sentence, then that fact must be found by a jury.
So, but basically what I hear you saying, and I, mirroring what Justice Pollack has said, it seems to me that the language of 662 and 606 are quite different. 662 says you can't impose extended unless these facts are found. Whereas 606 says the court shall consider these factors when imposing sentence. If we construe 606 as facts, just like 662 for extended or for minimal, as we said in Ault, we would have to have a jury trial for every single sentencing, is basically what you're saying. Because you're saying that 706668.5, which refers to consecutive,
yes,
refers back to 606. 606 factors are facts that must be found by a jury. 706668 says whether it's your sentence at the same time or for you're being sentenced for a subsequent offense, when you consider whether or not to impose consecutive, you have to go back to 706606 factors. So therefore, if we follow your argument, what that means is that whenever a defendant who is already subject to a term of imprisonment is sentenced for a subsequent offense, we have to have a jury trial to determine whether, for the jury to determine, and they have to go back and reconsider the factors from the prior offense to decide whether or not there should be consecutive sentences.
I have several responses. In terms of extended term, I know we're not talking about that right now. The state is required to give notice of its intention to seek extended term sentencing. If our position is adopted by this court, what that would mean is the state would have to give notice. And in fact, the state.
So that's not, you're saying in addition to the change of, I see. So if it's a jury trial, you have to give notice, you're saying.
In the charge.
So every time there's two charges, every time there's two felony charges, they'd have to give notice.
Yes.
Would be subject to consecutive sentences.
Correct. The reason I'm saying that the
sentence. And you're saying that the jury would have to find the facts as a part of the sentencing phase of a trial.
Correct. So if the 706-606 factors standing alone on the normal sentencing are discretion of the court, considers those. What we're saying separates it is when 706-668.5 says the court must consider it, and then in conjunction with Hussein, this court said that the court must make specific findings.
But then if that applies to consecutive, then why wouldn't the charge also have to give the defendant notice that you are charged with a Class A felony for which you are subject to up to 20 years imprisonment in the complaint? Why wouldn't that complaint or indictment have to contain that?
Well, because that's the statutory default of the sentence at that point. So in terms of a consecutive sentencing, they're asking for a longer, an extended sentence under our position.
So I'd like to ask how this would play out in this case, because the court made these findings that consecutive sentencing needs to reflect the seriousness and to promote. So it says that because there was four separate offenses, so here there obviously that was proven. The next thing the court says, these girls have had their innocence and their ability to feel safe in their community stolen from them at a very young age, and it has seriously impacted the rest of their lives. So the court's talking about the seriousness of offense. So under your theoretical framework, then the government would have to prove that these girls have had their innocence and ability to feel safe in their community stolen, and it seriously impacted their lives. So they would have to put on the four complainants in this case and ask them to testify how it's affected their life. That all came to the court, of course, in those letters that were submitted. So that's what you contemplate in the consecutive sentencing framework that you are asking us to adopt.
To some degree, correct. Well, it depends also which factors the state is going to base its motion for consecutive term sentencing on. So that would be a consideration as well. Obviously, under your scenario, there might be instances where the proof might not be as easy as another factor. However, in that sense, I don't think the court has ever limited due process rights or the significant rights of a defendant based on difficulty in implementing the procedure.
But I'm still reaching for how you would be able to argue that a factual finding other than just the default facts that are under 706-606, by default facts, I mean facts that by default have to be determined for every sentencing. How is it that you can argue that that there are provisions of 706-606 other than to protect the public? I see your point. It's mirrored in 706-662, but what else would the jury be finding?
Well, again, I guess it would depend on what the state is basing its consecutive term.
Okay. Well, let's say the state is going to base its consecutive term on 706-606-2A to reflect the seriousness of the offense, to promote respect for the law, and to provide punishment for the offense. Do you think under that particular factor there's enough of a, say, new factual determination to be made that would justify applying Apprendi? In other words, do we have a different analysis with respect to the applicability of Apprendi depending on which factor the government chooses to use in order to ask for consecutive sentencing?
No. Under our argument, whenever the government asks for consecutive term sentencing, they would have to follow the procedures set forth in Apprendi, regardless of which specific factors they're going to allege were present.
So further to Justice McKenna's questions, does that mean that in every indictment, if there's a possibility of consecutive sentencing, your argument is the possible sentence must be set forth in the indictment?
In terms
of... If the person has already been convicted of an offense and is already... And there's another indictment on a different offense, not multiple offenses in that indictment, but if there was a previous conviction, would that need to be set forth in a new indictment?
That the defendant was subject to consecutive term sentencing based on his prior conviction,
just because it's a new conviction.
If the state is going to seek consecutive term sentencing, regardless of what the underlying basis is, the circumstances, they should put it in the charge, in the indictment. And I think in Ald, the court kind of looked at this this situation and said, well, in terms of prior conviction, let's say, that is basically a factual basis. However, there were numerous considerations other than just the fact of the prior conviction that were required to be found, which is why it needed to be pleaded in the complaint.
I think what Justice McKenna was getting at, though, was would any possible sentence be required, not just consecutive sentences?
No, because we're arguing that, well, if any possible sentence that extends the defendant's normal term, yes.
How is an imprisonment not longer than a five-year potential shorter probation sentence? Why isn't imprisonment more severe than probation as a matter of law?
Well, I believe, and I can't I can't remember the case. However, the court, the U.S. Supreme Court, spoke of the fact that in a normal charge, a normal sentencing consideration, I believe it may have been Oregon v. ICE, that the defendant is aware that he's subject to these, to this specific sentence. When you extend it, when you're gonna add additional years to it or extend it by repeater, that the defendant is not presumed to have notice of. And that is what we're asking that the court put in there. Not every possible sense, so that, you know, the charge would have to read the defendant is subject to probation or a concur.
Would your concern be addressed if at the time of arraignment, the arraignment court notified the defendant that you are being charged with these offenses, which are subject to these sentences and the possibility of consecutive sentencing?
No, I don't believe that would suffice for extended term sentencing, so it wouldn't suffice for consecutive term sentencing. So we would argue that it would have to be in there as well, not just...
What other state courts have required jury trials for consecutive sentencing? It's clearly not required under the United States Constitution.
It's not required under U.S. Supreme Court
right.
law, and it's not required. In fact, candidly, of course, Kahapea said it was not, Apprendi did not apply to consecutive term sentencing.
Right.
However, you know, I think I'm out of time. However, in that sense, you know, we're asking that the court look at...
Are there any other states that have...
Not that I'm aware of.
In answer to that question, State versus Foster, the Ohio case, does apply Apprendi to a consecutive sentencing, but it does so based on a statute that requires an additional factual finding. So that definitely can be distinguished from our case, in which we have this interesting reference in the consecutive sentencing statute. We have an interesting reference to the, well, I guess you could say the default sentencing statute, so that there's no additional, technically there's no additional requirement for another factual finding under consecutive sentencing.
Well,
now, I understand your point is once consecutive sentencing is required, then there has to be some sort of a factual determination made to justify it. But I'm still reaching for what factual determination beyond, as Justice Pollack said, the jury. Because, correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Kinaga, but the analysis of Justice Scalia, that it seems to me that you're understandably promoting, the idea that, look, if you're extending the sentence, regardless of whether it's consecutive or whether you're going to call it an enhanced sentencing as a repeat offender, but once you enhance the sentence, if you do it based on an additional fact, then the Sixth Amendment's violated because you don't have your right to jury, right? However, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Justice Scalia, or assuming that analysis, still wouldn't apply in this case because there isn't that additional factual finding that's required. So even under ICE, I'm not sure that your argument would be applicable.
This court is free to interpret the statutes as it may. I mean, if there is no specific statute, obviously, that gives us what we're asking for. However, you know, this court has in the past used judicially created process and interpretation to create a means of relief where none was currently available. So that's what we're asking.
But I'm not sure where the relief is needed. If you already have the jury engaging in a factual analysis, then the Sixth Amendment's complied with. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me that's the core of what's being discussed with Apprendi. Right?
The jury verdict doesn't reflect specific factual findings. So the jury verdict just generally reflects that the defendant was found guilty in terms of the elements of the offense. The sentencing factors under 706-606 go beyond just the normal elements of the offense, and that's what...
And it seems to me that what you are advancing here would also apply to consecutive sentencing in district court also, right?
Correct. Under misdemeanor offenses?
Right.
Yes.
So we would be having jury trials on all potential consecutive sentences in district court also.
I think the issue, though, is that the state consecutive term sentencing, in my experience, is not the rule. It's more the exception. Not every case in which there are multiple counts alleged, not every case in which a defendant has a prior conviction.
I understand, but if there's a possibility, you know, their district court, there's cases that have multiple victims.
If the state, yes, if the state gives notice that it's intending to seek consecutive term sentencing, in any case that they seek consecutive term sentencing, we would argue that the requirement should apply. And, you know, I think I'm out of time.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Ekinaga.
Thank you.
But I'm sorry, may I just say that our third issue was that the law of the case applies.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning. I've been a deputy prosecutor for many, many years. In fact, I'm going to go to the Apprendi issue real quickly. I was the deputy on CAWA, and we went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court on that.
Can you just speak up a little bit?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
And there's only one case in my whole career that I remember the exact date, and that's Apprendi, June 26, 2000, because it's been a long and arduous road. And I'm of the firm belief and opinion that Apprendi does not apply to consecutive term sentencing. I'm not even sure how realistically and practically that would work in the circuit courts and, well, district courts if it were to apply there. There's just too much for a court, I think, to grapple with in terms of the 706-6 factors that may not even be apparent at, let's say, a change of plea stage, and may become more apparent after charging when we're done with a trial, given all the facts that come out.
No, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but help me with that. Wasn't that the argument that was made initially with respect to applying Apprendi to extended terms? And now we have a process that was...
Well, my recollection of Apprendi is it involved a hate crime aggravator, which this court has always been on the forefront of. Any fact that aggravates a sentence had to be determined by the jury. I think we go back to Schroeder on that. So this court has always been well ahead of that. It's just that when it got to the necessary...
What is your understanding of what the instruction is to the jury and an Apprendi finding for sentencing?
Does for it go extended to term,
it was a hate crime, or
well, if you're looking at the heinous, there's a separate statutory section for heinous. I think that was the Jonto case.
Okay, so under 706-662, is there an instruction that's given to a sentencing jury under Apprendi?
It's been a while since I've looked at an extended term, but I think it's fully covered by the statute and this court's previous case law.
So we have
on how
a process.
Definitely a process in place.
And I appreciate your point about how maybe it's more difficult if you apply it to consecutive sentencing. So can you help me with that?
Well,
how is it more difficult?
I would go back to also that it doesn't exceed the statutory maximum. So the statutory maximum on a Class A is 20 years. When you apply for extended, now you're applying for 20 to life. So now you're extending beyond the statutory maximum indeterminate sentence.
I understand. I appreciate that analysis, but I was trying to understand your previous point about how this would be an unworkable process under consecutive sentencing once it got to the jury, assuming that it
right.
did.
I think it would be a difficult process all along, and I would refer the court to what the majority said in Oregon v. ICE, which has a very similar statute to ours, not identical, but it operates similarly.
It's actually quite different. The Oregon...
Okay, I might be making a mistake.
Yeah, the Oregon statute, actually, the legislature mandated. In fact, what Justice Ginsburg said is that she's mentioned that there's three approaches on consecutive.
Correct.
And she said most states continue the common law tradition. They entrust to judges unfettered discretion whether to sentence for... shall be consecutive or concurrent. That's unfettered discretion. That's the first track. The second track, she said, sentences for multiple offenses are presumed to run consecutively, but sentencing judges may order concurrent sentence upon finding cause. So so there's a couple tracks like that. And she said that there's no dispute whatsoever if the state adopts these kind of tracks, that consecutive sentencing doesn't result in a jury determination. And Nobody disputed that. In other words, it's only when a legislature mandates a specific finding that there was a 5-4 dispute in this case.
Correct. And ours is different in that regard. In fact, I think our default now is concurrent, when it used to be they had the, not a default, but certainly there was a presumption it could run consecutive in the past with the law. I think the law was amended in 2015.
I'm sorry. I think what Justice Pollack is referring to is that in this case, rather than the consecutive sentencing statute requiring an additional finding of fact, in Hawaii, the courts just referred to the default factors in 706-06, and that makes it significantly different than the statute that was applied
Correct.
In ICE, where there was a specific requirement.
Ours is more of a traditional sentencing going back to common law.
It's okay.
I think that one of the issues that the petitioner brought up is that, well, there's going to have to be notice requirements, and we put that, for extended term, we put that in the indictment. And then we had the new special session, the change in the law. So there's a lot of checks and balances to give defendant his due process and notice. I'm not sure how that would even work within a consecutive term sentencing scheme.
Ms. Thomas, I really apologize for interrupting you, but we're going to take a short break.
Oh, okay.
Thank you. I apologize, Ms. Thompson. Thomas, please go ahead.
I was going to move on from the Apprendi issue, if possible. Justice Pollack, I agree with your earlier point with Mr. Ikenaga. Their real issue here may be on the record that's not before this court, and that's with what the Hawaii Paroling Authority did or didn't do. I don't know if it's a Coulter issue, whether the minimums increased. I mean, I did look at those documents, but those documents are not part of the record on appeal.
Your position, I think, in the answering brief was you seem not to contest the issue that he's entitled to the amount of years that he spent.
As a general proposition, where I think every prosecutor is going to agree that a defendant is entitled to every day that he served.
On each of those sentences.
Yes. The issue becomes how maybe those credits are applied. I believe the case law is for consecutive term sentencing, it applies to the aggregate of the consecutive.
But that's for pretrial detention. I mean, there's two different subsections involved.
Correct. And that may be an issue, but I believe that's for a different proceeding, a Rule 40, with the paroling authority and the Department of the Attorney General.
If I understand you correctly, then your analysis would be that the paroling authority in this case would apply the 17 years in a way that would not mean 17 years of credit for the Class A felony, the 20 years.
He's probably got 20 at this point, I think, or nearing that since it was 2017. But how it impacts his parole eligibility, the consecutive sentencing, may be possibly an issue. But that's not the issue that's before this court today, because we have no record of the parole eligibility issue.
Okay. I agree with you that how the HPA applies it may create an issue for us subsequently. But in terms of whether he gets credit, that is a statutory interpretation that's dependent on 706-671-2
correct?
Which this court could address, could it not? Because the court is interpreting whether or not this individual is entitled to credit on each of his individual sentences that he has served.
Yes, I think, I know there's a, well, actually, I think in this case, the ICA pointed to their decision in Canosa, which was an SDO, but you look at the effect on the aggregate and you look at the effect on the individual sentences. So in this particular case, I'm not sure I understand what you may be asking me, Justice Pollack, because my understanding of the case law is credit for time served is applied to the aggregate when you talk about consecutive. I'm not sure that you wouldn't want to penalize the defendant who's pretrial or pre-sentence versus someone who's already been sentenced previously. Because in a way, don't we go back to his position now? His sentence was illegal, the extended term sentence. So now we're back to position one, and that probably is technically like pre-sentence credit, right? Because now he's being sentenced anew.
There are two different subsections, and the philosophy under the two are remarkably different. And you don't consider him as a he's been serving not as a pretrial detainee. He's been serving as an inmate in an adult correctional facility serving a sentence, and those sentences stay with the law. Seems pretty clear. When a judgment of conviction is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime, the period of detention and imprisonment theretofore serves shall be deducted from the minimum maximum terms of the new sentence.
Okay, and he has no minimums, so his maximum would be 60 years.
Because it doesn't.
The 1 year.
It says when a judgment, when a judgment of conviction or a sentence is vacated and a new sentence is thereafter imposed upon the defendant for the same crime, the period of detention and imprisonment theretofore served shall be deducted from the minimum and maximum terms. It's pretty clear. The language is pretty clear. When the sentence is vacated, he gets credit.
Okay, and I wouldn't agree that, and maybe this is a question for, because the before I get to that point, I just want to say, there, as far as I could tell, there is no attachments, which we normally see with a judgment, of all the credit for time served with respect to the 2017 judgment. And maybe it wasn't in mine. I checked the notice of appeal. I didn't see that the petitioner had attached it. So I'm operating under the assumption that he's getting his credit, but I don't agree it should be credit for the first 20 consec, the second 20 consecutive, and the third 20 consecutive. Then that would seem to me to defeat the purpose of the court's sentence.
It doesn't defeat the purpose at all. Why would it defeat the purpose? It only defeats the purpose, arguably, because it took so many years here to get vacated. But the fact is, if he's been serving under a sentence, how can it not violate due process to say sentences that he's completely already served? All of a sudden, you're going to say, sorry, we were just kidding. You weren't actually serving. You weren't actually serving time under those sentences. You have to redo it. That's what would be the outcome.
Well, that's not my understanding, but I accept that's what you're telling me, Justice Pollack. But then, as petitioner says, he would be out in just a few years.
You had the option.
I'm not sure what.
Actually, during the jury trial for the extended, and you chose to go for the.
That may not have been an option that the state wanted to proceed on below, given the age of the case. I just want to sum up. I think it's evident that the law of the case doesn't apply in this situation. I think the two transcripts, if you read Judge
Del Rosario's, pretty clear there are cogent reasons.
Yes. Yes. And even then, I do believe that to bind another circuit court judge on something like that, a sentencing issue which is so specific and trying to address the offender and the offenses in terms of punishment. So if there's no further questions.
Explain to us why it wouldn't make sense to apply the 17 years for each 20-year sentence.
I understand what you're saying, Justice Nakayama. That's not how I read the statute. And so as I stand here today, it would seem to me that in consecutive, my understanding
is... I didn't mean it in an argumentative way. I wanted you to explain your sense.
I read the sentencing court and the pleadings below, and the sentencing court reason for consecutive was to address one of the primary concerns, too, under 706-606 for the court, both courts, was the fact that we have multiple victims and the egregiousness and violence and the crimes. And like I said, I know I'm not making this as clear as I should, but my understanding is it's applied to the aggregate. His minimums did decrease on most of the offenses. So my understanding is that it has been applied correctly, and there's been no due process or double jeopardy violation by either the sentencing court or the paroling authority. Thank you.
Does he have any time left? Why don't you take a couple of minutes to wrap up?
In closing, I'd just like to point out to the court that in Hussein, this court foreshadowed the problem of consecutive term sentencing being used by the state as a means of circumventing the normal protections afforded to defendants by the Apprendi-type procedure. And this is exactly what happened in this case. The state filed a motion for extended term, motion for consecutive term in the first case. By the time the second sentencing came around, the state just relied on consecutive term sentencing and got effectively the same sentence. Mr. Thompson would be in prison for the rest of his life. Finally,
that's only if, in fact, we apply that subsection in the way that the government may or may not be arguing.
Yes, and I would just like to say that we would probably have to challenge this via some sort of extraordinary writ versus a Rule 40. The only reason why is because the Rule 40 will take so long at this point that Mr. Thompson, and if credit for time served is significant in this case and it needs to be changed, he will be significantly prejudiced by any delay in changing his sentences at this point. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o malolo ia mai ne, ke ia aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hanohano. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.